might as well get going. What's happening today? We are wrapping up chapter 6. Just a few more slides on that PowerPoint, and we can go over anything that you're confused about or I confused you about. And then we're going to go over, start with chapter 7, which is the sensory systems. But we're going to stop the exam for next Thursday at the end of this chapter. We're talking about the synaptic transmission in chapter 5. And then the sensory system will be on the next test, okay? But general concepts still apply. You know, everything that we talked about that you generally will remember, okay? So what's going to happen today is we're going to go through, finish up those PowerPoints, get on to the sensory chapter, end a bit early so you can take that wonderful quiz and be done in 5 minutes. If you know the answers, it's really quick. You don't have to work out math problems or anything like that too much. Relatively easy. Okay, but it's individualized, so we're not going to do the scratch off on this one. We're going to test your own knowledge. How about that? And then we'll separate out and span out in the lab, in the class. Okay, and then next week, what do we do on Tuesday? What's happening on Tuesday? Review, that's right. So what are you going to do this weekend? Study, that's right. And go over the test banks, come to Tuesday with questions, right? Because that Tuesday is dedicated for you to answer questions. I mean, to ask questions, and I'll try to answer them. Or you can try to answer them, too. And so we'll go through all that on Tuesday. So if you study this weekend, it's going to be cold anyways. You just want to stay inside and study physiology. It's a great physiology weekend. All right, and then we'll go over everything on Tuesday. Then what happens on Thursday? Test inside here. So, and it's only designed to be about an hour. Or, you know, you probably could finish a little earlier. Probably most of it will be multiple choice because it's easier to grade and get it back to you. Some open response questions, some short answer response. But I can't ask, you know, long, detailed, discussion-based questions in that short period of time. We'll save that for the second exam when we take that in the lab and have lots of time to think about your answers and write, get finger cramps, all that kind of stuff. All right. So the first test, how many points is the first test worth? Anybody remember? 80, that's right. Yes, somebody read the webpage. Great. 80. And so it's not worth as much as the second test. Why are we doing that? Because the first test is relatively easy, but also to give you kind of, you know, get you going, right? So you shouldn't bomb this first test. If you do bomb it, you've got some issues, need to talk about it, okay? And try to make sure that you understand this material. And the second exam will be more challenging because there's a lot more content involved and probably newer content that you might not have had in other classes so much. So the second exam is going to up the ante a little bit. And then we have the final, right? Okay, so let's go for it. And where are we? Yes. Okay. Well, we can... Well, where were we? I think we were right here, pretty much. We can review a little bit, too. All right, so remember, cell body, dendrites, like your alpha motor neuron in your spinal cord, right? Input onto this, graded responses. Why does it decrement from the dendrites to the soma? What are some reasons the amplitude dropped? Length constant, lambda, right? Leaky membrane has to dissipate as it goes around the cell, all that membrane, so it's going to drop that potential. Even the decay might change a little bit, you know, the rate of decay. Why would the decay? What are some factors for the decay rate? What's another term we have to remember? We're going to do charades again. Tau, right? Right, so tau, R, M, resistance of the membrane times the capacitance of the membrane. So that might even change a bit. And then if you can get to threshold, boom, we get the action potential, right? And the action potential goes up. Why do we have the action potential here? Why is it initiated there? Anybody remember? Somebody? Back there in the back of the audience? Are you awake back there? No? Oh, I know. You love it.
We could just do the quiz by pulling names out.
Okay. Cameron, Hester. Who's Cameron? Cameron here? No. More demerits. Okay.
We'll do something about y'all.
Joseph Humphreys, we hear. Yes, you know, you got the answer, I'm sure. Why do we get an action potential here at the Axon Hillock and not up here somewhere? What makes the action potential? What happens at threshold?
When the sodium channel is open?
Yes, so to do that, we have to have what has to be there. You said it. I'm just making sure we get it all together. Yes, they have to be there, right? So we have a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels here. All right, so that's it on that point. Good. So let's just back this up. Sensory neurons. You touch your hand, your skin right here. Sensory ending, axon, cell body, goes into your spinal cord. Where are we initiating the action potential? Cell body's up here in your dorsal root ganglion. Where's the action potential initiated? Is it A, right at the sensory ending? B, a little ways, you know, in from the sensory ending? C, somewhere up here at the dorsal root ganglion? D, at the synapses inside of your dorsal root ganglion? A, B, C, or D? Yes. How many for A, right at the sensory ending? How much just a little ways away from the sensory ending, maybe? A. How about the dorsal root ganglion, like the cell body here, right? And then how about in the spinal cord? And then the others don't care. Okay, that's E. All right, so you're right. If we had to have a graded response all the way up to get to the cell body, like that figure there, this is why I bring this up, because it gets confusing, we probably wouldn't make it, right? The action potential or the electrical response wouldn't make it because of lambda and tau. It's too far to go. So you initiate the action potential close to the sensory ending, not right at the sensory ending, but very close to it, and then because of the high density of voltage-gated sodium channels, and then we get the action potential to travel up the axon, past the cell body, and then into the dorsal root ganglion. I mean, into the dorsal horn. So I just want you to think about those density of voltage-gated sodium channels, all right? And we'll talk about, well, we could do it now. It's kind of interesting. Well, I'll put it all in context before we forget. So, joint receptors, like in a crustacean, right, are, you know, they move. And we'll be talking about that in the next chapter. So, they can move their limbs, insects, right? There's actually a joint receptor that spans the joint, and it stretches. And there's sensory endings embedded in that little strand. Let's think there's a strand, like, from this side to this side of this joint. And you move, and it stretches that strand in there, right? Okay, you get it? And there's sensory endings embedded in that little strand. It's called an elastic strand or a quarter tonal organ. And if you stretch that strand, it stretches what? The endings. What does it activate to get ions to move across the membrane? Stretch activated channels, right? Those are proteins and they're in the membrane. So stretch activated channels, ions then can flow across that membrane because they open up. And then you have a graded response, and if the voltage-gated sodium channels are high enough, like this gentleman said, then you get the action potential, and the action potential can travel into the animal's nervous system. Well, what's kind of interesting about many invertebrates is the cell bodies are located very close to the sensory endings. So in this type of example, it's much like that picture up there. The sensory ending, like the dendrite, is right there in the strand. The cell body is right next to it. And then right past the cell body, you have a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels. And then, boom, it can travel up. Isn't that pretty cool? So it's kind of like what we see here, but it's a sensory ending. But the cell body's not like dorsal root ganglion, it's right there close to the ending. But if you look at the joint receptors that are up on the crustaceans, your favorite critters, right? Crayfish. If you look at the joint receptor that's at the base of the leg, called the coxobasal joint, it also has to span that joint. But it only has to travel to the ventral nerve cord. What's kind of interesting, it's the same organization. There's a strand, and the sensory endings are embedded in that strand, and the cell body is right next to it. But guess what? It doesn't make an action potential. It only has a short distance to go, and it's a graded response. Isn't that interesting? And there's hundreds of neurons that are in that little strand to sense that stretch. But there, you don't make the action potential, but you go out farther in the leg, you have to make an action potential, otherwise it's going to decrement too much, right, before it gets to the site of transmitter release to then activate the nervous system to say where its leg is. So it's kind of interesting in these differences. The idea is, when you have to travel long distance, make action potentials. Okay. Is that just confusion? All right. Okay, so think about these responses that we've been talking about, and if you're taking any standardized things, you definitely should know this general figure, and we'll go over it over again and again. But this is a cross-section of your spinal cord. This is the dorsal going out the back up here, dorsal here, and ventral towards your belly side. This cross-section, this butterfly, right? Your psychology test, butterflies. This little butterfly shape, you should know it. Why is it shaped this way, and why do we? What do we call the butterfly? What kind of matter do we call the butterfly? Remember, anybody? Somebody said it, maybe? But my hearing?
Gray
matter. And then the outside, white matter, right? Why is it gray, and why is it white? White matter is the myelination, the wrapping around those axons. So these are paths that go up and down the spinal cord around the gray matter. The gray matter is called gray because there's not much myelin there. This is where the synapses are taking place. So something else to remember in this butterfly. Here's your dorsal root ganglion. Here are the cell bodies of sensory neurons coming in. They come in the dorsal horn. So these are called horns because they look like horns, I guess. So this is called the dorsal horn, and this is the ventral horn. So sensory neurons come in the dorsal horn, and kind of schematically shown this way, some of those then might synapse right onto cell bodies right there. Some of those paths actually cross over and go to the other side, and then will synapse into inner neurons over here, and some will go right on down to the motor neuron and stimulate right on the motor neuron. Is there an example that you might remember of a monosynaptic type of response like this, where a sensory neuron comes in and goes right to a motor neuron and then fires that motor neuron? It's called monosynaptic, one synapse. Common on standardized exams. Woo, there it goes. It's okay. Anybody have an idea what that might be?
Reflexes. You,
pardon?
Reflexes.
Yes, what type? What's a good one for that one? You probably did it when you went to the doctor's office.
Your knee?
Yes, your knee, your patella, right? You had the knee crossed and you've seen all those kind of cartoons and commercials where they kick the table up in the air, right? But you hit right below the patella, the knee, and that will cause the stretching of this tendon and then supposedly a monosynaptic type of reflex to then activate motor neurons and the muscles and fire. Okay, so you should know a cross-section of a spinal cord. But the idea with this is this integration of synaptic inputs. So what do we have? If we're recording from the cell body, for example, here, then we can see communication from multiple neurons impact, you know, influencing how that motor neuron fires. So if they come together, they could summate, but we've also talked about another factor besides just summation that could happen, like coming down. Remember? Do you remember that? Let's do this so it gets on this webcam. I think it should actually record on echo now that they came in and fixed this thing. All right, so kind of a review again. Is this thing functional? No. Why is it zoomed in so much? Okay, focus. There we go. Okay, so if we had input here and this is summating, and we have multiple inputs like boom, boom here, right? And we recorded in this dendrite or in this cell body right here. And we saw, let's do this, about the same amplitude. And we saw those adding together, what would we call this? The same spot, but in time, right after each other. Temporal summation. And if it came from maybe another dendrite over here and this one here, and these responses came together, and then we had summated here, spatial, right? Spatial summation. Okay, so that's good. Alrighty, so try to remember some of this stuff. Okay, and then you see what's happening here, depending on excitatory or inhibitory inputs relatively at the same time, then you could dampen that excitatory response. Generally, in your nervous system, most of the inhibitory input is not out in the dendritic tree, but where? On the cell body. And that's pretty neat, because if you have inhibitory input on the cell body, and you can control all the excitatory input coming in, right? Doesn't matter which part of the dendritic tree that it's at. But you have a lot of inhibitory input right on the cell body, so then it can be like a master regulator of all the excitatory input that's coming in. So that's pretty neat, too. General ideas that we've talked about. So we've kind of gone through some of this before, but here, just to remind you, if you stimulate a neuron, you give current injection into that neuron, then you can cause that neuron to increase the firing frequency, right? Because you're activating those voltage-gated sodium channels and you're keeping that highly activated, whereas if you just activate a few of them, then you're going to have a lower firing frequency. We'll talk more about this when we enter the sensory chapter about rate of stimulation, but the idea is then you depolarize that cell, you can get multiple action potentials to fire. Okay, and we've already talked about facilitation, for example, but this is a good point to stop here as well. So remember, Kharari blocks acetylcholine receptors, right, on the muscle fiber in mammalian preparations or in the frog preparation. And why did Bernard Katz use Kharari in these preparations? Somebody out there? Why do you want to keep it below the threshold? Right. Because if you go to a threshold, you're going to get an action potential, and it's all or none, right? And then you can't really get a good index of what's happening in synaptic transmission. So sub-threshold was to block most of the acetylcholine receptors to keep it sub-threshold. You could do other techniques such as lower calcium or high magnesium, right? And that would cause less calcium to come into the nerve terminal for fewer vesicles to fuse. And so basically the same kind of idea if it's subthreshold. But remember, we talked about short-term facilitation. If you have two stimuli close together, what happens in the presynaptic nerve terminal? Calcium comes in, and then what goes on with that calcium? Pumped out, exchanged out, taken up by calcium binding proteins, taken into the mitochondria, right? But if another potential came down that nerve terminal, opened up voltage-gated calcium channels again, what's going to happen to the calcium inside? It's going to increase. It's going to add. So this is called the residual calcium hypothesis. Residual calcium hypothesis to explain short-term facilitation. Bernard Katz showed that in the 1950s in the crayfish neuromuscular junction also. Then he did that in the frog neuromuscular junction, sub-threshold, and could see the same kind of responses. So residual calcium. And then we mentioned that you could inject those chelators that bind calcium into the axon, and you could actually show that you don't get those kind of responses, that it's really calcium. People did that again in the squid axon with calcium indicators, and you could see that calcium rise. And the second time you stimulate, you even saw a greater calcium rise, and you would see the short-term facilitation. So multiple ways to show the same thing here. But this is a little unique. This is what happens in the brain slices. So textbooks kind of jump around a lot, and sometimes it's hard to put this in context. So we've been talking about multiple different types of preparations. If we looked at a hippocampal slice preparation, why do people use a hippocampal slice preparation? Why is it such a big thing? Why does everybody talk about that inside the neuroscience community? Ideas out there? Anybody have 50302 before?
Memory.
And what kind of memory?
Long-term,
but some key elements with that too. Formation and spatial, partly spatial too, right? Spatial memory. And so, you know, like, you know, when you get up in the morning and the lights are off, you know the way around your apartment or house, right? And you kind of have the spatial memory. Just damage that area and you lose that spatial memory. Okay, but not just that. It's an interesting point for that. But why experimentally do people want to use this, or why is it used? There's other really interesting parts in the brain, too. But the rationale is that you can slice it. You can slice the brain up, and this is a nice slice where you can stimulate the tracts that go to the neurons that you're recording. A lot of other parts in our brain are very convoluted, and you can't stimulate one spot and record in the other so easily with a slice. So people are trying to figure out other areas where they can slice in the brain in other directions instead of like this, and see if they can look at circuits. The hippocampal slice is a nice preparation, easy preparation. Remember, what does that kind of fit with some terms or some points that we've mentioned before, particularly in chapter 2 of this text? What we're kind of talking about, where you would want an experimental animal that's most suitable to address your question, like the kangaroo rat with the kidney, right? Here's kind of an August Croak principle. It's a really nice preparation. You can study it well. And so it's been hammered to death. It's hippocampal slice preparation, but also for memory. But it's easy experimentally compared to any other slices in the brain to actually study. So you can look at neural circuits. Well, this is an interesting point. And this is a little confusing. This slide confuses people over the years. But the key element here is that this is a percent control. So they're looking at this y-axis as a percent control. You could redraw this yourself if you wanted to. Maybe list this as 100 and maybe put this as 20 or something and then take out the percent. That might help you to understand this. So you stimulate the tracts into the brain, and we can look at these tracts. Where are they? Somewhere up here. Okay. You can stimulate these tracts that come into the brain. You can record from these cells. All right, and that's what they're doing here. Okay. And you get, when you stimulate, you get this postsynaptic response. Boom. Let's say it's, for this example, let's just say it's 100 millivolts, okay? 100 millivolts, 100 millivolts, 100 millivolts. Then you repetitively stimulate, da-da-da-da-da, higher frequency, right? So it's 50 hertz all of a sudden. 50 hertz. And what are you seeing here? Some short-term facilitation. But during that time, you start to get some depression. And then you go back to a low-frequency stimulation. And now you got bigger responses. Whoa, these are even bigger. So it's not so much this residual calcium idea anymore. These are going on with the back to a low-frequency stimulation, but it's kind of like what we talked about before in the crayfish preparation, remember? Like turning on second messengers in the crayfish neuromuscular junction, that turns on kinases and can actually give you a bigger response. This situation's a little different, okay? And you got this, what they call potentiation. So it's potentiated, and then finally they'll go back down. Okay, now this is where it gets confusing. It went back to a percent of the initial, 100%. But if we took absolute amplitudes, let's say that's 100, let's say this is 20. That makes it more understandable. So now you have a small postsynaptic response. You repetitively stimulate it, and you get that short-term facilitation. And you got this enhancement, but you didn't see that depression. Why might not you see that depression real fast? One idea. NIH wants to give you money. This is a brain. This is a mammalian brain. Why might you not see that depression here? Just ideas from what you know already. Maybe you didn't do it long enough, but we did it as long as we did up here.
Over refractory periods?
Maybe refractory periods.
Calcium,
yeah, that low calcium. And what does the calcium do for the presynaptic nerve terminal?
Builds up over time.
Builds up over time. And we got the facilitation, but what else does it do? What does it cause to happen?
Vesicles.
Yeah, vesicles to fuse. So if you had less calcium in, you have fewer vesicles that have fused. So maybe you didn't use up the vesicle store, the regular releasable pool, right, of vesicles. So maybe you don't get that depression that way. So that's an interesting point. So this is why people have studied this over and over and over again to kind of understand what's going on in synapses and using different types of paradigms. I know it's a little confusing because you think about all the different experimental paradigms and different preparations and they function a little different. So I know that's confusing, right? But the general gist of this, you can see that there's a lot of plasticity out there in different forms to look at. We've already talked about this kind of idea of calcium coming in, and if you puff calcium right before you stimulate, you can get a bigger response compared to if you didn't have that calcium around that presynaptic nerve terminal. And so the point here is just it's calcium, extracellular calcium, that influences the presynaptic side for causing more transmitting. This is a really interesting diagram that's in lots of textbooks, and this is of a different type of animal. synapse that was described. And let me just go to the little critter so you see it. The ciplegia. It's a sea slug. Kind of ugly thing. But anyways, some really neat experiments. For example, you can touch on this little siphon that shoots water out, and you touch it, and it will withdraw, right? It's kind of like if you go visit relatives, right? And then little nephews and nieces are around, and they bug you all the time.
Right.
The first time they touch you, it's like, oh, yeah, pay attention. And by the end of the day, when they keep bugging you, you don't pay attention to them anymore, right? You've kind of habituated to it, right? You habituate to the sounds of the air conditioner in the room, too, right? It's still there. You're still getting that sensory information. You're just not putting so much emphasis on it, right? But then, what's the mechanism behind habituation? What's the fundamental mechanism? If the sensory neurons are still firing, why don't you have the same response? Right? You touch your skin, touch it again, you still fire it each time, right? Nephew's still bugging you, right? But you didn't pay attention. So higher processing, right? What's going on? Well, what kind of processing is that? So these are the kind of questions that people wanted to address. A guy, Eric Kendall, he went through medical school, and then he went on to residency in psychiatry, right? So after he finished medical school, then program in psychiatry, and he realized the brain's just too complex. The mammalian brain's so complex. I don't understand learning and memory. I don't understand how this brain's working. Maybe if we went to simpler systems, we could understand it. So he took time off from after finishing medical school and residency in psychiatry. And then he went to go to France, and he studied with some really famous invertebrate neurobiologists. And they went through a whole bunch of invertebrate preparations to try to understand synaptic communication. So he looked at all kinds of critters, sea animals, snails, land snails, and finally they came up with this critter, the aplysia, which is really quite interesting because of why. He noted a really interesting behavior. And the nervous system's relatively easy, another August Crook principle, right? So because the ganglion, the nervous system in this animal, is like little packs of ganglion that are all over inside the animal's body. And there's not that many neurons inside of each ganglion. So what he found is if you touch the siphon, it withdraws. Touch it again, it withdraws. Touch it again, maybe it doesn't withdraw anymore. Okay? So it habituated. But now you do something else. You touch it, and you shock it with electrical shock. Right? Touch it again, electrical shock. It's like, you know, if you went to the cookie jar, you'd quit going to the cookie jar, right? Because you're all shocking you every time. Right? So it's like the dog learning the shocking yard. Same thing. So, but what's the mechanism behind that? Now he could touch it, and it would withdraw. Touch it, and it would withdraw, and it wouldn't habituate so quickly, right? It would take a much longer time for it to habituate, even without shocking. What's the mechanism behind that? So he was very interested in what's the mechanism behind that. So that's pretty cool. And then if you did something else to the system, you could change, you could modulate those synaptic responses. So he wanted to understand this. So he looked at the whole animal behavior and then dissected out parts of the nervous system, and he could take an electrode and stimulate the sensory nerves and record in motor neurons and then begin to address how that neural circuit's working. And if you activated other parts of the neural circuit, how would that influence, say, a different part of the neural circuit? So beginning to understand modulation of neural circuits. So Eric Kendall was very good at this. Not only did he do this, but with repetitive stimulation that these animals could get, he saw genes turning on in the neurons that he was activating. These genes then could make proteins, and he looked at factors that could turn on these genes by activity profiles. And they thought, well, if they could do it in the aplysia, could they do it in a mammalian preparation? So then he went back and looked at mammalian preparations, mice brains, hippocampus, because why? You could look at the circuit, right? And he found the same kind of genes are turned on, these genes, and could regulate protein synthesis. So he got the Nobel Prize a while back, not just for working on aplysia, but pulling it all together and actually seeing that genes could be turned on with repetitive activation. It was similar across species, all the way from aplysia to mammalian models, and probably in our brain as well. So it's kind of interesting to look at this preparation. Some of the things that it came up with was something like this that's pretty interesting. If you activate the sensory nerve, what happens? We get an action potential that comes down, opens up voltage-gated calcium channels, but in that action potential to come down, what else is there? Voltage-gated sodium channels and voltage-gated potassium channels. But if he happens to activate this other neuron, while you're activating this neuron, something very interesting happens. Serotonin is released, and that serotonin binds to a receptor, turns on cyclic AMP in the cell, and that cyclic AMP closes the potassium channel. So what's going to happen to the shape of the action potential as it comes down, and then all of a sudden, there's not as many potassium channels? What brings the action potential down? Potassium going out, right? But if potassium's not going out as much, what's going to happen to the width of your action potential? It's going to become wider. What's going to happen if it becomes wider? It's going to stay depolarized longer, and it's going to open up what? Voltage-gated calcium channels. And therefore, then you get more vesicles to fuse, and you have more synaptic transmission, only by stimulating that other neuron and releasing some serotonin. So he showed that, but he also did some other neat experiments. He just puffed on serotonin and got the same kind of response. Then you can actually, in these preparations, you can actually put an intracellular electrode in here, and you could modulate the cyclic AMP levels. You could either block it or activate it and see how that influences. So we did all these kind of experiments. Not only that, they cultured these experiments and they recreated these synapses and these neural circuits in a dish. So you could take sensory neurons, you could take these other neurons, and recreate that whole neural circuitry in a dish and mimic what would happen in the animal. So that's pretty cool. So this is the kind of work that Eric Kandel did. He really didn't practice clinical work much after that, and he really got on to working, and he got the Nobel Prize, I think, in 2010, I believe, or something like that. Time goes so fast, I keep forgetting. And he still is at Columbia University in New York, has a very big research lab, you know, undergraduates, graduate students, postdocs, and then you get off to your own world. He has like 20 or 30 postdocs that continuously work in his lab. Some work on aplasia, most of them work on hippocampal slices, and now with the Nobel Prize, you know, money's pouring in, raining. And he continues to work on these kind of projects. So it's pretty neat in that sense. All right, so this is just a schematic of what we just said, increasing that action potential, and then you get more calcium to come in, you get more transmitter release. So it's a pretty neat, and here's the your shape of the action potentials and the postsynaptic response, and say that motor neuron, bigger response, right? Okay, and then I just mentioned about like the cyclic AMP injections to prove every step of the way and how this is working. So you can block these, you can add these. Lots of experiments have been done. People use aplasia all around the world. There's groups in Korea and China, Japan that are using aplasia to do the same kind of experiments or other experiments as well, and recreating whole behaviors like that in the animal, but in a dish. Okay, so we talked about these. So he actually worked a lot with long-term potentiation. There is a recording that has been done where they can actually give repetitive stimulation, and there's another term that's on the textbook. It's called extra long-term potentiation. So you could put like an E in front of it, E long-term potentiation, now extra long-term potentiation. And the guy, T.P. Fang, actually described that, and he was very good. He described that when he was about 90 years old. A really amazing guy. Okay, so that's kind of neat. But you can have much longer long-term potentiation. So let's go through a little bit of this. And we talked about the genes that could be turned on, that we just mentioned, like in the aplasia and in the hippocampal slice. Okay, so this is just that experiment that we've talked about with the repetitive stimulation, looking at those responses. Let's look at the synaptic responses then, right at the synapses in the hippocampus. This was first described a good number of years back. It has since been modified multiple times. At that time, there was a really strong debate in the literature. Some people were saying it's all postsynaptic. Other people were saying, no, it's presynaptic. And then it took about 10 years of fighting in the literature, people publishing papers contradicting the other, trying to do the other's experiments, and then finally they realized there's a little truth to both. And finally they came together, and they actually, these big labs, one out in California, San Francisco, another one in the East Coast, kind of came together and actually published the papers together and saying, yes, we agree with both. There's presynaptic components and there's postsynaptic components. Generally, right now, we're just looking at the postsynaptic components. So what happens with repetitive stimulation is, think about this. This is really neat. So you activate, this is a glutamate, all right? So glutamate. And it binds to two types of receptors. These are both glutamate receptors. They're just given different names because of the pharmacology. They respond different to different pharmacological agents. They both respond to glutamate. Okay? But one's called an AMPA receptor, and another one's called an NMDA receptor. The AMPA receptor is an ion channel that opens up, allows sodium to come in and potassium to go out. Now, if we just put glutamate right on the NMDA receptor, it really doesn't open. This is the general idea. It has what's called a magnesium plug. Okay? Generally. Like a magnesium plug. So it can't open. It's plugged up. It has to be depolarized. So you have to depolarize the membrane. This is the working postulation in this mechanism. It has to be depolarized. And then it's going to kick out, when this turns positive, it's going to kick out the magnesium plug. So now you have a channel that can open. So you stimulate a second time, and you release glutamate, and now what's going to happen? You're going to open up not only the NMDA receptor, but the AMPA receptor, but you're also going to open up the NMDA receptor. Because now the plug's gone. The magnesium plug's gone. But what's key here is the NMDA receptor allows calcium into the neuron. And when you allow calcium in the neuron, that can trigger many different things, right? That can trigger so many things like phosphorylation-dependent steps, calcium calmodulin, other actions. Get too much calcium to come in, you can actually induce cell death. Calcium-regulated cell death, apoptosis. So this is really important. But think about this. Then, you know, a little bit of stimulation, like one, you only get a little response. Stimulate it multiple times, and you're going to get much more of a response because you've opened up NMDA receptors as well. Okay, so that's kind of neat. But something else that's really neat, if you change this and you repetitively stimulate, let's go to this picture here. If you repetitively stimulate that long-term potentiation that we were talking about, they now know that these receptors can be just underneath the membrane. And depending on the activity, like calcium coming in, then these receptors, which are not functional yet, they're not in the membrane, insert themselves into the membrane. And now you have more AMPA receptors. So you're going to have a stronger response. That's that LTP. Okay, so that's pretty neat. It drove the field crazy for years, because how would you know that by staining with an antibody? You know, you got a neurons in a dish, right? We talked about antibody staining, right? How do you make an antibody, inject the animal, put a fluorescent tag. And anybody do that in a lab? Anybody use antibodies in a lab? Somebody's working in a lab? Nobody? Yes. How do you process your tissue to stain it with an antibody? You slice it, put it on a slide maybe? Process. You put it in a solution. Do you remember what kind of solutions you might put in ahead of time for the antibody to get in there? Okay, was one like between 100 TWEEM or soap? Remember using a soap between 100? Okay. So maybe check the protocols, because it depends what you want to stain. A lot of times if you're trying to stain thick tissue, you'll use this little soap of between 100. It's like a soap detergent, basically. And it pokes little holes in the membrane. And then you put your antibody on it so the antibodies can go in. Well, if you do that and you stain with the antibody, what are you going to stain? Like an antibody for these receptors. You're going to stain not only the receptors on the cell surface, but what else? The ones inside the cell, right? So you don't know they're on the cell surface. So they were seeing these changes in the physiology, but the antibody stains showed the same response, right? Because you were staining all the proteins. So it wasn't until they did experiments where they didn't permeabilize the tissue, or you had individual cells in a dish, and you didn't poke holes in it, then they could look at the surface and find out, oh, the surface receptors are changing. And that was really key. That broke the ice. And now we know that happens in many cases in your nervous system and other tissues in your body, too. Receptors can be right underneath the membrane and then be inserted in the membrane, or be taken out of the membrane. Think about turnover. All the proteins in your body have to turn over, right? They have to be internalized and turned over. But so here's that mechanism behind these kind of keys. But this was big news. So they found out that these receptors could be inserted in the membrane and get a bigger response. That was really cool. But not only that, where am I? Back here. Where did it go to? Oh, here. Then they found out something else. If you're repetitively stimulated, and depending on the conditions, I just want to mention, I don't want to get into all the details on the conditions, but they found out, depending on the stimulation conditions, you could get smaller responses in time too, called LTD. Just that you've heard this. LTD, long-term depression. And what they finally found out is that the AMPA receptors disappeared. So not only can you put them in, you can take them away. If you don't have the AMPA receptors, how are you going to activate the NMDA receptors? Right? You can't depolarize the cell. Well, so that's kind of interesting. So you can get a depression. That's a general idea. There's some nitty-gritty details in there, but we're the general idea. What's also interesting, think about this, which isn't in the text, and it's kind of interesting, and there's some papers just came out like, I don't know, a week or two ago, that people are still addressing this. Think of the dendrites, like my fingers, in the cell body, and they were inside the brain somewhere, right? In the hippocampus. And we stimulate, let's say this dendrite up here. Depolarizes, travels. Which way, if I stimulate it like at my knuckle, which way does that depolarization go? It's not an action potential yet, right? Because it has to go down, site of spike initiations here at the wrist. Boom. But that graded response is going to go which direction? Both ways. It doesn't, it's not just force down this way, right? It can go up the dendritic tree too. It can even go down and up this side, right? So now, what have you done? By activating this synapse over here on my index finger, and let's say that depolarization traveled over here to the pinky, what have you opened up over here? Or released the block from? The NMDA receptors, right? So now you have a synapse that comes over here after you've activated the index finger, and then you activated the pinky over here. You get a bigger response activating the pinky than you did if you didn't activate this index finger, right? Get the idea? So that synapse is happening over here in the pinky, it's not equal ever all the time. It depended on the activity that was over here. That is really cool. And that's opening up a whole new field to begin to study, to look at these kind of actions because of releasing a block and causing it to be more responsive. I think that's just fascinating. So people are putting that into computational programs, into computer programs, if you like computer programming. Computational neurobiology is a big thing. They offer a whole course that's just in computational neurobiology at like these marine labs that we've been talking about. All right. So just to wrap this chapter up, some other aspects that you might have heard about that can alter synaptic transmission, like biogenic amines, dopamine, they can modulate the synapses. Exogenous ligands that you could take, you know, like wild mushrooms, for example, they can influence synaptic transmission too, so we call those exogenous ligands that can modulate synaptic transmission. And cannabinoids can alter synaptic transmission as well. And that's a common interest these days. Okay. Other things really interesting to think about, strychnine, pretty neat. You might have heard of strychnine. It can actually block, it can inhibit, it competes with inhibitory synapses. So if you can block inhibitory synapses, what's going to happen? Too much excitation, right? So this is pretty neat. So if you block the inhibition, you get too much excitation. And people use this to model like epileptic seizures in rodents. They'll actually give them strychnine so they get a seizure out of them. So that's kind of neat. Tetanus toxin is another really interesting compound. You know, tetanus that you can get from the dirt, soil, right, gets into your body. And it actually can travel into your neuron, travel in your neuron, and then influences neurons that synapse onto the neuron that actually took up the toxin. It's kind of interesting, but it prevents the release of GABA from neurons, and it seems to be specific to GABAergic neurons. People are still trying to figure out how is this so specific. So this is pretty neat too. So if you inhibit the release of GABA, you can get excitation. So you've probably heard of somebody in tetany, you know, tetanus toxin, they're all contracted up, right, because you're getting too much excitation. And these toxins are really quite interesting. People use them experimentally, but you might hear people actually, you know, you get your tetanus shot, right, after you had maybe dirty cut in your hand. It's not so much rusty nails. It's kind of a misnomer, right? But it's a rusty nail that's in the dirt, right? And that dirt, the soil, has bacteria. It has this tetanus, this toxin, bacterial toxin that can get into your blood, and then you get this toxin into your body. All right. Really, some other aspects. Anybody ever see black widow spiders? Black widow spiders, yes. They exist here in Kentucky, right? Go hiking. You can. We don't talk about them. No, they're not good. All right, they're out there. Yeah, it brings up bad memories. But I actually brought some to my kid. They were going to middle school or elementary school. It was like show and tell time. I put it in a nice container, sealed it, wrapped it up, so they could actually show other kids what a black widow spider toxin is. You know, spider, to show other kids not to play with these kind of things if they're in your backyard. Boy, I got a call from the principal in a heartbeat. But anyway, don't ever bring these toxic things to classrooms. But anyway, I thought it was educational. Anyways, what they do is really quite interesting. They can be taken up inside of the nerve terminal, and they cause vesicles to just fuse. Just cause a whole bunch of vesicles to fuse. Primarily at the acetylcholine neuromuscular junction. So think of your neuromuscular junction. If you get spider toxin, it can cause a lot of transmitter release. And then it depletes it, right? So you don't have any more vesicles to fuse there that are packaged. So it's kind of interesting. People use these experimentally. You might hear about it in the lab being used because they're trying to release all the readily releasable vesicles. And then they'll stimulate or find out if they can recruit new vesicles to the synapse. So it's kind of an interesting experiment. Carrari, we already talked about. And both of those can be bad if you get too much of it, right? Myasthenia gravis. Anybody ever hear of myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disease? Right? You might have heard of that. People, it's not that uncommon. But it's an autoimmune disease that attacks the acetylcholine receptors. That's kind of interesting, right? Because this comes up with people, basically they're walking around, they're kind of uncoordinated, and they're, you know, wondering what's going on, you know, and they go to the doc, and the doc says, you're just not quite, your reflexes aren't quite working right, and, you know, what's happening? And then so they start to do the clinical test, and they find out that maybe you have this autoimmune disease, which can happen sometimes after a viral infection, for example. Your body just kicks this in, and then you need to get these antibodies out of your body. Now, stignine, you might have this maybe used even when you go to the ophthalmologist, when they dilate your eyes, for example, because they can inhibit acetylcholine esterase. What's another compound that inhibits acetylcholine esterase that we talked about?
Serin.
I think we... Pardon?
Serin?
Yeah, these nerve gas agents, right? Nerve gas agents are insecticides. They're basically nerve gas agents. These insecticides, some of them, pyrethrin is a sodium channel blocker, but these other ones, you look at the list and it'll say a cholinergic blocker, but it's really this acetylcholine esterase blocker. And so they block the acetylcholine esterase, and then you have an altered synaptic communication, okay? So that's kind of interesting to think about. All right, so, it's already 20 after. I've talked too much. All right. So we are going to just think about the sensory system. I won't go too much in depth because we've got to stop and take this quiz. Sensory systems. After the test we have on Thursday, that following week we're going to go to, actually, what are we going to do? We're going to keep harassing you so you can't say you forgot. We're going to go to the labs the week after the test. So you do have lab. The other section's not going to do it, but we're not going to do a lab. We're going to have fun labs. But we're also going to go over the exams that you have in the smaller groups, right? So we're going to go over the exam and your scores. I'll get them all back to you by then. And then we're going to go over the answers so you understand that. But we're going to do some fun activities too. Sensory activities. So it's all about sensory activities. Then we're going to go to the outreach center, the medical outreach center, and do some other fun things. Okay, we already got reserved times for these, for every section. All right, sections. All right, but sensory systems. Is that not cool, sensory systems? Think about it. Close your eyes, for example. Think about going around life without vision, right? Like some people have to do. Or without hearing, right? Or without smelling, right? I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. Think of your touch, right? You can feel pretty well, right? But how important is, like, pain reception? Pretty important, right? You sprain your ankle, you don't want to keep aggravating it anymore, so you ease into it, right? So you won't... So you think about all pain, hot table, right? You burn your hand on a table, right? The oven's on, and you burn your hand, you're not going to do it a second time. You've learned, right? Pretty quickly. But think about how important sensory reception is. So let's just think of your senses. What do we have? Vision. I know this is elementary, but let's just make sure we got it. Vision. Smell.
Taste.
Hearing.
Touch.
That was five, right? Six is, I'm guessing, what's in your brain. All right, so those are like external receptors, right, for the external environment. But you also have interoceptors, right? You have proprioceptors that detect your joint movements. You have pain receptors, like, inside your gut and stomach. But many type of receptors in your body, right? We talked about osmoreceptors, reception in your brain, right? Like that fluid that's, say, more dilute or more concentrated, that can change that how that neuron stretches or shrinks, and it's going to change stretch-activated ion channels in there, so it's a receptor, in a sense, for your osmolarity, pH reception, right, with CO2, we talked about that. So there's so many neat things out there in reception. So, you know, you can kind of go through these first slides on your own a bit. We'll skip through that. But kind of just go through these processes, these different types of receptors. We don't have all of them that are listed on there, like electroreceptors. Some sharks are very good with electroreception, right? They can detect this. You think it's really the blood so much, but they've really tested it as primarily electroreception. If you have something cut, you're electing electrolytes, and they can detect that. They can put these little like cathodes under the sand in an aquarium and put like positive and negative electrode, and a shark will go right for that electrode. So they're very sensitive to that electric field potential, and that's how they can detect like leaky blood out of an animal. So it's not so much the blood so much, it's this electroreception. Magnoreceptors, like pigeons, you know, migrating, for example, very good about electric fields. All right, so you can kind of go through that, and we'll talk more about these proprioceptors and external senses, and then your perception, right? You might have the same reception as the next person, but maybe you respond more to that than the other person, right? You might be more sensitive in the integration. So that perception in your brain, kind of like we talked about with habituation of noises. So many neat things with vision out there that's really quite cool. Like these optical illusions, right? Like the two circles, you kind of think they're different, but they're the same. But a lot of animals use these optical illusions too in their environment, and how they might attract a prey, a partner, for example, and like that nesting going on over there. Something to be attracted to a mate, for example, or peacock feathers, you know, get the idea. All right, so we will talk more about all that later, sensor, but right now we're going to take a quiz. And so what we need is people to, and the same on the test that we're going to talk about later on Thursday. Now, for the quiz, I can kind of watch around, but, you know, on the test, I just want to tell you ahead of time, those kind of watches that people have with the little texting thing that goes off or in your pocket when you take tests, just to avoid you having any problem. And earphones, like ears of your telephones that are in your ears. And what we can do now is that we can get lots of space between everybody. Look at all these chairs up here in the front against the walls. Lots of space, lots of space. Does anybody need pencils? If you need a pencil, I can go around and pass it around later. But lots of space, no one next to each other. This is not a communal effort, individual effort. Okay, lots of space. There's lots of space over here. Back there, in the back. Guys that are sitting next to each other, come on, spread on out over somewhere. Like if you're next to each other, you can spread out over here somewhere. Spread out. Remember to put your name in here. It might be best if you actually print it so I can read it. Thank you very much. And I'll start with the video. Here's later. Here we go. So we're going to not touch each other anymore. We're going to do this. Remember, try not to be wandering eyes. It's pretty quick. You'll finish all the time. I'll stand in the back. Tattoos on your arms. down there?
Yeah.
All right, I'm right there with him.
Everybody's going to go so pretty. And get you the same time.